First case for argument is case number 20-1844, Eastern Arkansas, Angelique Tillman versus Allstate Property and Casualty Insurance Company et al.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Brian Wallace on behalf of the appellant, Angelique Tillman, and we have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal time. Everybody knows that Allstate turned its claims process into a money-making scheme by lowballing small to medium-sized claims in order to make a profit off of its insureds. Despite being called on this repeatedly and entering into an agreement with multiple state insurance commissions, including the state of Arkansas, to stop its unfair claims practices, Allstate is continuing to do this. This is what this case is about. And Angelique Tillman is one of those insureds that has been harmed by Allstate's continuation of its settle for X or less default to trial claims practices. Once Tillman or other insureds are subjected to Allstate's bad faith claims handling abuses, they sustain other injuries beyond a breach of contract injury. This is what happened to Ms. Tillman, and it's also why the jury's decision on the breach of contract claim is not decisive of the bad faith claim. Here, the district court's grant of summary judgment to Allstate was based on an absence of proof in the record showing bad faith, and therefore was derivative of its order denying access to discovery related to those bad faith claims. Consequently, if this court holds, as appellant's request it does, that the district court erred in denying the discovery that that erroneous ruling resulted in a fundamental unfairness and prejudice to Ms. Tillman, requiring reversal of both decisions. Moreover, unlike this court's recent opinion of Amador versus 3M, a fundamental unfairness occurred because Tillman was denied discovery regarding Allstate's state of mind when handling the claim, what processes, policies, etc. it used in doing so, and as we detailed in the briefing, other specifics held only by Allstate, which were relevant and proportional to Tillman's bad faith claim.
You know, it's a very demanding standard when you look at it. You know, you've got to show, as you've said, fundamental unfairness, and then you have to go beyond that, to show prejudice. And really, the underlying test is not a mere abuse of discretion, but a gross abuse of discretion. And that's really quite demanding. Now, in order to do that, you have to balance that with the rule, and the rule talks about proportionality. Now, if you look at this particular case, what are the specific facts that you had in your possession that would lead to believe that this discovery was tailored narrowly to fit the scope of discovery under that proportional standard?
Your Honor, you're correct. It is a taxing standard. However, it is met in this instance. And we know this because the facts detailing the bad faith were very well laid out in the complaint. There were multiple paragraphs going over what Allstate has done historically, what Allstate continued to do, and what Allstate did with Ms. Tillman. It was also pled that this discovery would be held in the hands of Allstate, so we would need to get it from them. Some specifics that I've identified were paragraphs 500 to 502, 506 to 508 of the complaint on appendix 73 to 75, where Allstate continued to use Colossus for the purpose of substituting evidence that went against its position, for instance, the impairment rating. Our expert, Mr. Fye, whose affidavit was attached to the reply for the motion to compel, discussed how this was a classic case of applying the settle for X or less company philosophy, which they had agreed to stop doing. They also agreed that they would implement certain policies and would not rely solely on Colossus when evaluating claims. As was pled in the complaint and also argued below and in the briefing, the claim files, the policies that they had, what they did when evaluating this claim were relevant to and proportional to the specific case that is brought here. Another specific instance would be, which has been found to be bad faith in Arkansas, which would be in, under the Merrow case, which would be turning a blind eye to the law applicable in the state regarding what damages can be shown and the actual proof that the insured gave to the company for evaluating the claim. For instance, in this case, because Ms. Tillman hired the Cheneys to represent her, Allstate evaluated the claim differently. That has specifically been held to be evidence of bad faith or evidence to support a bad faith in Arkansas law.
As I saw the record, I thought maybe it went to her advantage, didn't it? Didn't they sort of come to the table quicker because of that?
No, Your Honor, they didn't come to the table quicker because of that. What they did is they put her information into a box, which was a minor impact soft tissue box. And when they do that, they put it into Colossus, and it spits out a number, and that's the number that they gave. When they were presented with evidence such as a chiropractor's future impairment, future medical information, which Arkansas recognizes, one of the Allstate supervisors told the claims handler, do not consider that. You cannot consider that. We don't consider that. That's completely in conflict with Arkansas law, which allows chiropractors to provide such testimony. And we provided Allstate with not only that information, but with the cases and also medical journal articles and things like that showing this correlation.
So the maximum on this policy was what?
I believe it was $50,000, Your Honor.
And she was ultimately offered $40,000, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So even if you've got a theory about sort of general practices within the company, it seems to me you've got to specifically attach your evidence to her case because she's a single claimant here, a single plaintiff. And how do you do that with such a small range between the amount offered and the maximum amount under the policy?
Well, Your Honor, because of the distinction between a breach of contract claim and a bad faith claim, the bad faith claim looks at how they evaluated, whether their state of mind when looking at this claim and performing the evaluation. Here, and this goes to why we needed the discovery and the claims file and why it doesn't matter what the jury verdict was or what they ultimately settled after, you know, going back and forth a little bit more, is that we specifically requested the reserve set for the claim file and all the evaluations. These documents may have shown that Allstate knew the claim was worth more, but negotiated for a lesser amount instead. Under Findlay and Newton, these are evidence of bad faith.
But isn't the value of the claim established by the jury's verdict? I mean, because that's the number that the jury says made your client whole and complete under for the loss that she incurred as a result of the automobile accident. And when you offer three times what the jury thinks the case is worth, aren't you by definition just swimming upstream on this claim that there was some bad faith?
No, Your Honor. The jury's assessment of the testimony is different from what the insurer does who purposely disregards proof. This isn't just a mere failure to investigate a claim. As previously stated, it's Allstate's willful blindness and conscious disregard of what the law is and the evidence, and is evidence of Allstate's ill will and state of mind. And this is why it's such an important distinction in Arkansas law, is that a breach of contract claim is not required to sustain a bad faith claim. In Edgen, cited in our briefing, the court originally, there was a breach of contract claim brought as well as a bad faith claim. The breach of contract claim was settled and it was allowed to go to trial on the bad faith claim. Though Arkansas does not require there to be a breach of contract for all for a insurance company such as Allstate to engage in bad faith practices. And that is what we had here, is we had allegations very detailed in the complaint. We had an affidavit from an expert saying, based on what's been pled, based on what I've seen in other cases, based on what I've looked at, this is what Allstate continued to do here.
And yeah. About that affidavit, you know, Judge Miller essentially described it as a hunch leading to a hopeful fishing expedition, right? I mean, that's, you know, he didn't use exactly those words, but that's, as an old trial judge, that's what I hear him saying. And why is he wrong?
Well, first, a fishing expedition is no longer a valid objection to discovery. And when proving a bad faith claim, the documents almost always lie in the hands of the insurer. And here, the claims file, I mean, it is entirely possible that the claims file may have shown we were wrong. But we don't know that because none of these documents were turned over. Our expert didn't have the ability to take those documents and compare them to what has been found to be bad faith claims practices and claims handling to what was done in this case. We were basically handcuffed in trying to prove our case without the actual documents that could prove the case. We were left to only rely upon these allegations and, as you just put it, the hunches of the insurance experts, because there was no documents to actually look at and to consider, which goes to the fundamental unfairness of the court's decision to dismiss the bad faith claim for a lack of proof, because we weren't allowed to get the proof. The court denied us the ability to get to proof. And even when Allstate said they would turn over documents with a protective order, Allstate never sought that protective order, nor did they turn over any of those documents. Your Honors, I see I'm about to run into my rebuttal time. I will go ahead and pass to Ms. Runyon at this time, unless there's a further question to follow up on that statement I just made.
I see none, so thank you, and you may reserve the rest of your time.
Thank you.
Counsel, we're ready to hear from you. Having a little technical difficulties. I don't know if you're not unmuted yet.
Let's try that. Is that working?
Yes, that sounds much better.
Okay. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Emily Runyon, and I can tell the technical difficulties with my screen, but is my audio remaining?
I am able to hear you, and if the others nod, I think everyone is able to hear your argument.
Great. Thank you. I was honored to represent Allstate in pretrial litigation and at the trial of this matter in March of 2020. There are two issues that we are here about today from appellant, one being discovery rulings and the other regarding the summary judgment ruling. Before I go into, I believe that the discovery rulings really kind of roll into what the judge ended up doing on the summary judgment. So I'd like to start with those discovery rulings. However, I also want to start first with the main issue that has been touched on here, is that there cannot be prejudice shown and damages shown in this case. The bottom line is that this case was a claim by Ms. Tillman. Allstate did agree to coverage for UM coverage when she was hit by someone that did not have insurance. And the policy at issue was $50,000. The initial offer on the case was $32,000. Before a complaint was ever filed against Allstate, the last offer was $40,000. The issue ended up in front of a jury of her peers, and they decided it was worth $12,000. So the only evidence in this case is that Allstate actually overestimated Ms. Tillman's claim. So whatever the company did in the handling of her evaluation resulted in an overestimation by quite a bit in what her claim was actually worth. Therefore, she cannot show prejudice and she cannot show damages. Even a bad faith claim requires the showing of damages.
Counsel, is it your position that even had the plaintiff been allowed this additional discovery, there's no way that the jury verdict would have been any different?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is exactly Allstate's position. And if you start looking at, first off, I don't believe that if you look at everything that the judge was looking at, I don't think you're going to find a gross abuse of discretion on any of the discovery rulings. However, the bottom line is, even if you did disagree, or if you put yourself in that position as the judge and you thought, well, I think I would have handled that a little different, you aren't going to find a gross abuse of discretion. But even if you did, and the floodgates opened and Allstate had to produce everything in its company, it would not have changed the jury verdict. It would not have changed the outcome. But I do want to...
We know that for sure, since we don't know at all what's in there. I mean, because the argument of opposing counsel is clearly that, you know, you deprive us of any opportunity of finding out what your policies are, what you've been doing, what your state of mind was when you were making these decisions. And by doing that, we were deprived of an opportunity to develop our case. The judge took away our bad faith case, you know, and I get the idea where, you know, I don't know what the custom and practice is in Arkansas. You know, in North Dakota, our practice has always been you bifurcate the bad faith claim from the underlying claim. You try the damages case first, and then you try to the same jury, you try the bad faith claim over so that the bad faith claim doesn't bleed into the damages claim. Now, opposing counsel is arguing that you don't need to show the breach of the contract in order to get to the bad faith claim. And, you know, if you never know what the evidence is, I mean, how do we really know?
Sure. I'd like to touch on that for certain. I would like to start with telling you what they did have to consider and what the district court knew that they had to consider when they filed their motion to compel. So in May of 2018, Allstate did respond to discovery, and while it had to make objections to the overbreadth and the proportionality, it did not just serve objections. It gave all the policy documents that were relevant to Tillman's claim. It gave while there's all this discussion from appellant about not having the claim file, they had the entire claim file only with redactions for privilege. And that was a 3,524-page claim file that was produced. And in the grand scheme of things, there was only 140 pages or portions thereof, so less than 140 pages, that had redactions. So it had the policy documents, it had the claim file, and before a complaint was ever filed against Allstate, Allstate also produced the one Colossus report that was ever done in this evaluation. So there's a whole lot made of this, you know, well, they're still using Colossus. Well, the agreement with the insurance department was that they could use Colossus. There was just certain, it was how they used it. And they turned over the one Colossus report that was done in this case. So they got claim file information. They got certain reserve information. While some reserve information was redacted after attorneys got involved and there was attorney-client privilege, they had all of that to consider, and they got that in May of 2019. By the time the motion to compel was filed 9 months later, they had not done anything except argue with Allstate about Allstate's objections and what Allstate wasn't turning over in the realm of company documents and corporate documents. And in that claim file, what's interesting and I think very telling about what Ms. Tillman's counsel was really after in this case, the claim file had 38 different claim handlers and claim specialists, and the information and what they did in this case, everybody that touched it, that information was all there. And the only thing that Allstate got was a very broad 30B6 notice for a company rep to talk about corporate things that had happened decades ago. And there's a very good discussion in appendix page 456 through 460. It would take me all of my time to discuss what happened in the past with Allstate and the agreement. But that's all they wanted was a 30B6 to discuss all of these things that were not relevant to Tillman's claim, which was evaluated in 2015. Never once did they ask to depose actually the claim specialists and the claim handlers that were involved in Ms. Tillman's claim, that evaluated it, that had their hands on it, that could have told them how they did it. They didn't depose any of those people. So when they came to the court with their motion to compel asking for all these other documents, they could not make a connection, and they could not tie what happened in Ms. Tillman's claim to all this speculative information about why they think they should get all these documents. I mean, basically what they were telling the court is, because we put bad faith in our complaint and because we've alleged bad faith, that we're entitled to all of these different categories of documents. And when they were arguing the motion to compel in front of the court, they did not narrow that down and say, court, really what we're looking for is, you know, numbers 20, 18, 5, and 7. And if you can look at those, and if you could, you know, really what we're looking for is this, and we're willing to enter a protective order, and we're willing to narrow the scope because this is really what we're looking for. Instead, much like the brief that's been filed in this case, there's just broad categories of information that they think they're entitled to because they have simply alleged bad faith. Regarding the protective order, Allstate had not been asked by the court to produce additional documents because the court didn't find that there was that necessity. Regardless, Allstate never withdrew its offer to produce certain things. It said, you know, Allstate was trying to be reasonable and said, hey, we'll produce these certain things we think are relevant to Ms. Tillman's claims, but they are documents that anytime we've ever had to produce them, they've been subject to a protective order. So if you'll agree to that, we won't. And the reason that opposing counsel would not agree to the protective order was because it would not, our suggested protective order would not allow him to use the documents in other cases. And we had a discussion between the two of us about how does that help Ms. Tillman? To the detriment of your own client, you won't sign this protective order because it won't allow you to use it in other cases. And so—
Counsel, is anything about that protective order, is that in the record? I read that in the briefing, but did that ever get to the court?
It did, and that discussion, it was attached to some pleadings as exhibits, but you can find it at Appendix 1599 and 1600. As far as the discussion between counsel, you can see it in emails. As far as an order on the protective order, that never came in front of the court because, you know, while Allstate was saying, hey, we would agree to this protective order, opposing counsel would not agree, and the issue never came before the court because opposing counsel never came to the court and said, hey, even though you told Allstate they didn't owe these things, they're willing to give us these things with a protective order, but we can't agree on it, and we don't think they should get what they're asking for. So here are these protective orders. Which one do you want to enter, court? Because we want these documents. They never did that. So there's no ruling on the issue about the protective order, and there's no ruling on the documents that Allstate was willing to hand over in the end. So, you know, that is really the lens that the court was looking through when it needed to decide, am I going to grant this motion to compel or deny it? You know, he had to take all of that information and everything that the plaintiffs had been given and what they hadn't done with it. And then he also had to look at, what is this case really about? I mean, that's what 26B1 asks him to do. What is this case actually about? And at that time, what the court knew was that this case was about an MVA that happened in 2010. Ms. Tillman was 25 at the time. She had already been found 100% disabled by the Social Security Administration. It only caused $400 worth of property damage. She didn't suffer any broken bones, no serious injuries, no cuts, no abrasions. She had several previous accidents, which she claimed personal injury from. She had several after that she claimed personal injury from. And, you know, again, in the end, he also had to realize there was only $10,000 left. Allstate was getting all of these allegations against it for not offering the last $10,000 of their policy limits. And Ms. Tillman was treated, you know, by 5 chiropractors, a dentist, and a PCP. And, you know, that PCP ended up, this was a discussion in Allstate's response to the motion for summary judgment, that PCP ended up as a witness that was in the unfortunate situation of having to testify that he actually didn't author a report that was given to Allstate in support of Ms. Tillman's claim. So all of these things go into this consideration of what does the court want to do. And 1 year later, when no depositions have been taken by opposing counsel, they've done nothing with the discovery they did have. He has to decide, am I going to continue this case that's been pending for 9 years? And he decided he wasn't going to do that because they had not proven that they have not had not proven that they had entitlement to these documents. And there just can't be a gross abuse of discretion in those findings. And if you look at the cases cited by appellant for these discovery rulings and saying that when you add bad faith to the claim, you get all these documents, there's four main cases they cited. Only two were in Arkansas. One was Allstate versus Dodson, which wasn't a bad faith case. And one was from 1992. And in that case, that was the Viking case. That case was cited over and over and over saying that it stood for the notion that carriers' files were critical to the discovery of the truth. Well, if you actually look at that case, there was a conversion claim in that case as well as a bad faith claim. And that line, critical to discovery of the truth, was in the court's discussion on page 323 of the conversion claim, saying that, you know, if you've got different portions of a claim file, like there was a salvage section in that one, and they hadn't produced all of the sections of the claim file. So that's not at all akin to what happened here. The claim file was fully produced. It just had redactions that counsel made objections on. And then you turn to the motion for summary judgment of bad faith. You know, that was filed by Allstate in May of 2019. And rather than it being responded to on the merits, it was responded to by, again, asking for more time for discovery. And I think it was, as was touched on earlier, it was an affidavit, not of the party or not of an attorney, saying here are the specific facts that we think exist and why. It was from an old expert that, again, was grasping at straws from something that happened decades ago and not what happened in Ms. Tillman's claim in 2015. And there was plenty for him to look at in what Allstate had produced at that time. So, again, Your Honor, I don't believe that any of those decisions were in error by the district court. And for those reasons, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's rulings.
I want to just ask one really brief question. You know, there's been some conversation that, well, 40,000 is close to 50,000 and that's, you know, magical. And it may be in the right case magical, but you would concede that there are times when if you offer $49,000 the settlement of an automobile injury with a $50,000 policy limit, that it may be in bad faith. For example, you have, Mike Trout is killed in a car accident and he's lost $25 million a year over the next, 10 years. If you don't pay the 50, that would be in bad faith, wouldn't it?
I mean, I agree that on a different case with different facts, I don't think that $10,000 is really a magic number at all. I think what's magic number in this case is that what the offer was 40, and what a jury of her peers said the claim was worth was 12. That's the magic number.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And now we're ready for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Brian Wallace again for the appellant. I want to touch on a couple of things that were brought up during Ms. Runyon's argument. She said that Allstate turned over what it thought was relevant. That's not the standard. The standard under Rule 12b-6 looks at six specific factors to determine proportionality. Here, the court, presumably because it went to the overbroad proportionality discussion, found that these were relevant documents. And the discussion of, we gave them something with redactions and we said they were privileged. That, just saying something is privileged, an attorney-client privilege, without producing more, without producing an affidavit, without providing those to the court for an in-camera review, doesn't just give Allstate carte blanche to not turn that over or to redact it.
Moreover, did you ever ask for an in-camera review?
It's not our responsibility, but I believe it was requested within the motion to compel or in the reply when they brought up the privilege argument. But that's not our responsibility. And that goes also to a boilerplate objection. The notes on use of Rule 26B specifically says a boilerplate, overly broad, and not proportional objection is not sufficient. Affidavits, other things must be put forth to show that. Allstate did not do that here. Instead, as the court relied upon below and what was done, is it was just counsel argument saying it's not relevant, it doesn't matter. The reason why an abuse of discretion occurred here is that in U.S. versus Taylor, the United States Supreme Court said care must be taken to ensure a district court's discretionary choices are guided by sound legal principles and not the court's inclination. Here, the court's inclination was, as Allstate just argued, this is just a breach of contract claim. It's a low property damage claim. But there was a bad faith claim here. There were specific allegations of bad faith. There were specific things discussed and alleged about what the claims adjuster did here, what she told Ms. Tillman, their insured, and what happened. And this is why the policies and the practices are so vital to determining a bad faith claim and why that discovery should have been turned over and why there was such a fundamental unfairness here that resulted from that denial. It's how they used Colossus that matters. They say, oh, there was only one Colossus report. Well, the claims adjuster said, oh, we reevaluated. We did other things. We did this. Well, what are those other things that you did? Where's that claims diary that sets that out? Where is that in the claims file? What policies did you have in place? What training did you have in place to make sure that your adjusters were not violating or engaging in bad faith claim practices? And these things are the reason why, when the claim was dismissed, there was a fundamental unfairness to Ms. Tillman requiring reversal. I see I'm out of time, Your Honors. Thank you so much for the privilege of being here today.
Well, we thank both counsel for your arguments here today. We will take the matter under advisement.